Welcome back. It's good to sit with you again. Shall we continue with the story of Perseus? This is chapter 9. I think we can finish this story today. But to start with, let me tell you about the fulfillment of the prophecy that started this whole adventure to begin with. Perseus decided to go to Larissa for the games. I don't think it was a complicated decision for him. King Teutomides was hosting funeral games for his father. Athletic competitions, feasting, a gathering of men from across Greece to honor the dead through contests of strength and skill. Perseus had heard about it the way young men hear about such things, through travelers, through sailors, through the kind of rumor that spreads when something worth witnessing is about to happen. He just finished the impossible, killed Medusa, saved Andromeda, freed his mother from Polydectes. He was a hero now, properly speaking. The kind of man people would tell stories about for generations. But he was also still young, still mortal, still someone who wanted to test himself against other men in ways that didn't involve monsters or gods or curses. He wanted, I think, to feel normal for a moment. So he went to Larissa with Andromeda, and I went with them because I'd been watching Perseus since before he was born and I wasn't about to stop now. The journey north was easy. Good weather, clear roads, the kind of late summer traveling that makes you feel like the world is generous. Perseus was lighter during those days. He laughed more. He and Andromeda would walk together in the evenings when they stopped to make camp, and I'd watch them talk about small things. What kind of house they'd build, what their children might be like, whether Mycenae or Tiryns might welcome them. He wasn't thinking about Argos. He wasn't thinking about his grandfather. Why would he? Acrisius was an old man locked in a bronze tower of his own making, still cowering from a prophecy spoken before Perseus took his first breath. That part of the story felt finished to Perseus. Not resolved, maybe, but no longer urgent. He'd survived what Acrisius tried to do to him. He'd become someone worth fearing. That felt like enough. I knew better. I knew Acrisius had fled Argos the moment he heard Perseus was alive and returning. I knew the old king had run north, desperate and terrified, seeking refuge with Teutomides and Larissa. I knew he was there already, sitting in the stands, watching the athletes prepare, trying to disappear into the crowd of spectators and mourners and competitors. But Perseus didn't know. He arrived in Larissa with joy in his step, eager to compete, ready to throw the javelin and the discus alongside men who'd never faced a Gorgon, but who could still teach him something about balance, about form, about the pure physicality of being young and strong and alive. I watched him enter the city, and I felt the air tighten around us, not with malice, not with divine intervention, just with the simple, terrible certainty of what was already in motion. Some threads once pulled don't stop until they're fully unraveled. I need to tell you about Acrisius, because if I don't, you'll think he was simply a villain. You'll think he was cruel for cruelty's sake, that he locked Danae away and tried to drown Perseus because he was heartless or mad or drunk on power. But he wasn't any of those things. He was afraid. The oracle at Delphi had told him he would die by his grandson's hand. Not might die, would die. The Pythia doesn't deal in maybes or possibilities. She tells you what's already written, what's already true in a future you just haven't reached yet. And Acrisius heard those words and felt the ground disappear beneath him. He'd spent his whole life trying to control things. He was a king. Control was supposed to be his birthright. But you can't control prophecy. You can't negotiate with fate. You can only run from it. And that's exactly what Acrisius did for decades. First, he locked Danae in the bronze chamber. No windows, no doors, no way for any man to reach her. If she never married, never bore children, then there would be no grandson. Problem solved. Except Zeus doesn't care about bronze walls or a father's paranoia, and Danae became pregnant anyway, golden light pouring through the seams in the ceiling, and Acrisius's careful plan crumbled. Then he sealed them both in a chest, his own daughter, his infant grandson, and had them thrown into the sea. He told himself it wasn't murder if he didn't use a blade, if he let the waves do the work. He told himself the gods would understand. He told himself a lot of things while he listened to Danae screaming his name from inside that wooden box. But they didn't die. Perseus survived. And when Acrisius heard the rumors years later, whispers of a young man with Danae's eyes and Zeus's favor, alive and hunting Medusa, alive and turning kings to stone, he knew the prophecy hadn't forgotten him. So he ran. He abandoned Argos in the middle of the night, took only what he could carry, and fled north to Larissa, where King Teutomides owed him old favors and wouldn't ask too many questions. He arrived hollow-eyed and thin, looking older than his years, jumping at shadows. Teutomides gave him shelter, gave him a place in the crowd during the funeral games, let him pretend he was just another exile seeking distance from his failures. I saw him there in Larissa, sitting in the stands with his cloak pulled up around his face. He looked small, shrunken, like fear had been eating him from the inside for so long there wasn't much left. And I felt something I didn't expect. Pity. He'd wasted his whole life running from one sentence spoken by a priestess in a dark room. He'd destroyed his family, betrayed his daughter, tried to murder an infant, and still couldn't escape. Every choice he'd made to avoid his fate had only brought it closer. The prophecy didn't need his cooperation. It just needed him to keep being afraid. I wondered if he knew Perseus was coming to Larissa. I wondered if he'd heard the young athletes talking about the hero who killed Medusa, if he'd recognized his grandson's name being spoken with admiration instead of fear. I wondered if he understood yet that there was nowhere left to run. Larissa was alive with celebration when we arrived. The city had opened itself to the games the way a flower opens to sunlight. Everywhere you looked, there were bright tents and cooking fires, merchants selling wine and honey cakes, children running between the crowds pretending to be wrestlers or javelin throwers. The air smelled like roasted meat and olive oil and dust kicked up by hundreds of feet. People had come from all over Greece, athletes, yes, but also their families, their supporters, anyone who wanted to witness something worth remembering. Funeral games aren't somber affairs, despite the name. They're celebrations of life through competition, honoring the dead by showing how vital and strong the living can be. King Teutomides' father had been a good man, well-loved, and the games reflected that. There was grief woven through the joy, but it was the kind of grief that makes you want to live harder, compete fiercer, prove that death doesn't get the final word. Perseus registered as a competitor the first day. I watched him give his name to the officials, saw the slight widening of their eyes when they realized who he was. Word spread quickly after that. The Perseus, the one who killed Medusa, here to compete in the discus and javelin throws. By evening, everyone knew. The other athletes looked at him with a mixture of respect and challenge. Some wanted to compete alongside a legend, others wanted to beat one. I watched him train in the days before his events. He was good, better than good. His throwing form was clean and powerful, the kind that comes from natural talent refined by discipline. He'd learned balance fighting monsters, how to plant your feet when the ground is uncertain, how to shift your weight when everything depends on precision. Those lessons translated here. When he threw the javelin in practice, it flew straight and far. When he hefted the discus, testing its weight, you could see he understood it instinctively. Andromeda watched from the sides, cheering when he made a particularly good throw, teasing him gently when he got too serious. She was good for him that way, kept him from disappearing too far into his own head. He'd smile at her, shake out his shoulders, try again. The stadium filled slowly over those few days, stone seats climbing up the hillside, packed with spectators who'd come to see the best athletes in Greece test themselves. The wrestling matches went first, then the foot races, then the chariot competitions. Each event was accompanied by roaring crowds, by winners crowned with olive wreaths, by the kind of electric energy that happens when humans push themselves to their limits in front of witnesses. Perseus's event was scheduled for the fourth day, the discus throw, 5 competitors, including him. The prize was a bronze tripod and the honor of being remembered in song alongside King Teutomides' father. I sat in the stands that morning and watched Perseus stretch, loosen his shoulders, breathe deep and steady. He looked calm, ready, alive in the uncomplicated way young men are when they're doing what they were built to do. And somewhere in that same crowd, 12 rows back and hidden behind a pillar, Acrisius sat and watched his grandson prepare to throw. The discus is heavier than people expect. It's not just weight, though. Its density, concentrated mass that sits in your palm like a promise. Bronze, smooth and cool, with just enough texture to grip. You hold it flat against your forearm, fingers curled around the edge, and the whole throw depends on understanding that weight, respecting it, letting it pull you into the spin rather than fighting against it. Perseus knew this. I could see it in the way he held the discus during his turn, testing its balance, feeling how it wanted to move. The four athletes before him had thrown well, good distances, solid technique, nothing extraordinary, but nothing to dismiss either. The crowd had settled into that attentive hush that comes when people are watching something that requires real skill. He stepped into the throwing circle. The circle itself was just a flat area of packed earth, marked with a low stone border. Ancient rules, ancient measurements, the same way men had competed for generations. Perseus planted his feet, positioned himself sideways to the field, the discus held low and back in his right hand. I've watched thousands of throws over the centuries. I've seen Olympic champions, warriors, gods disguised as mortals, testing themselves for amusement. But there's something about watching someone you've known since before they were born, someone you watched learn to walk, to fight, to survive, that makes even a simple athletic competition feel weighted with meaning. He started the windup. A smooth rotation, building momentum, his body coiling like a spring. One rotation, then into the second, his arm extending, the discus cutting through the air as he spun. The release point came at the perfect moment, that instant when centrifugal force and human intention align, when the throw stops being effort and becomes flight. The discus left his hand clean and fast. A beautiful throw, the kind that makes other athletes nod in appreciation even as they're calculating whether they can beat it. It flew straight for the first half of its arc. Perfect trajectory, good height, traveling the way a well-thrown discus should, spinning flat and stable, eating up distance. And then the wind caught it. Not a strong wind, not a gale or a storm gust, just a breath of air moving through the stadium at exactly the wrong moment, or maybe exactly the right moment, depending on how you think about fate. The discus wavered mid-flight, its spin destabilizing. It curved left, still traveling fast, still carrying all that momentum Perseus had given it, but no longer going where it was supposed to go. The crowd noticed. I heard the shift in their collective breath, that intake of surprise when something unexpected happens. Athletes started tracking the discus's new path, some standing, some pointing. It was heading toward the spectator stands now, curving away from the field at an angle no one could have predicted. I saw Perseus's face. He'd seen it too, the moment the wind took his throw, the moment control disappeared. He was already moving, already shouting something, but sound travels slower than bronze through air. The discus sailed into the crowd on the left side of the stadium. People scattered, tried to move, but crowds are slow and packed tight, and the discus was fast. It struck someone in the stands. I heard the impact, dull and terrible, even from where I sat. Everything stopped, not metaphorically, literally. The entire stadium went silent and still, thousands of people frozen in the breath between action and consequence. Even the wind died as if it had finished whatever work it had come to do. Perseus was running before anyone else moved. He vaulted the stone border of the throwing circle and sprinted toward the stands, toward where the discus had fallen, toward whoever had been hit. Other people started moving too. Athletes, officials, spectators climbing over seats to reach the injured man. I didn't move. I couldn't. Because I'd seen where the discus landed. I'd seen which section of the stadium, which cluster of seats. I'd seen the old man with the cloak who'd been sitting alone, who'd been watching Perseus throw with an expression I couldn't read from this distance. And I knew, the way you know things sometimes before your mind catches up to them, exactly who was lying in those stands with blood on his face and the crowd gathering around him. The prophecy didn't need Perseus to hunt his grandfather. It didn't need revenge or confrontation or justice. It just needed a discus and a breath of wind and two men in the same place at the same time. Sometimes fate is that simple. Perseus reached him before most of the crowd did. I watched him push through the spectators, saw officials trying to clear space, heard people calling for physicians, for water, for someone who knew what to do. But I could see from where I stood that there was nothing to be done. The discus had struck the old man's temple, the thin bone there, the vulnerable place where one blow can end everything. Perseus knelt beside him. I saw his hands hovering over the body, not quite touching, like he was afraid he'd make it worse somehow. Like there was still something that could be made worse. Someone brought water anyway, someone else brought cloth. People do that, try to help even when help has already arrived too late. It's a kind of prayer, I think, a refusal to accept what's already finished. The old man's cloak had fallen back from his face. His eyes were open, staring up at nothing, or everything, or whatever people see in that last moment before seeing ends. There was blood, but not much. The wound itself was almost neat, just the terrible precision of bronze meeting skull at exactly the right speed and angle to stop a heart. Perseus stared at him. I saw the exact moment recognition started to dawn. Not all at once, but in pieces. The shape of the face. The age. Something familiar in the features that Perseus had only ever seen in his mother, in his own reflection, in the bloodline that connected them all, whether they wanted it or not. Someone in the crowd said the name. I don't know who. One of the locals, maybe. Someone who'd seen Acrisius around Larissa these past months. Just said it quietly to the person next to them. That's King Acrisius, from Argos! The name spread through the crowd like water seeping through cracks. Murmurs, whispers, then louder voices as people realized what they were witnessing. Someone said, isn't that Perseus's grandfather? Someone else said, the one who threw him in the sea? Perseus heard them. I watched him hear them, watched each word land like another blow. His face went through several expressions too fast. Confusion, denial, understanding, horror. His hands were shaking now, still hovering over his grandfather's body, still not quite touching, like contact would make it more real than it already was. No, he said, just that, quiet, almost to himself, no. But prophecy doesn't care about no. Prophecy doesn't listen to prayers or denials or the desperate bargaining of young men kneeling beside their grandfathers in the dust. It just is, the way sunrise is, the way winter is. Inevitable and indifferent and complete. Andromeda reached him then. She'd been sitting too far away to see clearly. But she'd fought through the crowd when she realized something was wrong. She knelt beside Perseus and put her hand on his shoulder, started to ask what happened, then saw his face and stopped. It's him, Perseus said. His voice sounded hollowed out, like someone had reached inside him and removed everything that gave words weight. It's Acrisius, my grandfather. I killed him. It was an accident, Andromeda said immediately. The wind caught it. Everyone saw. Perseus, it was an accident. He looked at her like she was speaking a language he used to know but had suddenly forgotten. Does that matter? And that's the question, isn't it? Does intention matter when the outcome was written before you were born? Does accident mean anything when prophecy has been waiting patiently for decades, knowing exactly how and when and where you'd fulfill it? The officials came then. Teutamides himself, looking stricken. His funeral games had turned into a different kind of death entirely. He spoke to Perseus gently, told him no one blamed him, told him it was a terrible misfortune, but clearly not murder. Other athletes gathered around, nodding agreement, offering comfort that bounced off Perseus like stones thrown at bronze. They carried Acrisius's body away, wrapped him in the cloak he'd been hiding behind, lifted him onto a board, took him to wherever they took bodies during funeral games that had just claimed an unexpected victim. Perseus watched them go. He was still kneeling in the dirt, still in the position he'd taken when he first reached his grandfather. I wanted to go to him, wanted to kneel beside him the way Andromeda had, wanted to tell him. What? That fate is cruel but not personal? That he'd done nothing wrong except be born and throw well and exist in the same city as the man who'd tried to drown him as an infant? There was nothing to say that would help. Nothing to say that wouldn't sound like comfort from someone who'd watched this coming and done nothing to stop it. So I stayed where I was, and I watched Perseus finally stand up, watched Andromeda take his arm, watched them walk slowly out of the stadium while the crowd parted silently around them. The games continued the next day. They had to, you don't stop funeral games just because someone else died. But Perseus wasn't there to see them. He'd already left Larissa, heading south and west, away from Argos, away from the city whose throne he'd just inherited through the most efficient and unwanted succession in Greek history. He never claimed it, never went back. never stood in the palace where his grandfather had given the order to seal him in a chest and throw him in the sea. Some inheritances, I suppose, cost more than they're worth. Perseus founded Mycenae instead. He couldn't rule Argos, couldn't bear to sit on a throne still warm from the man he'd killed, even accidentally, even fulfilling prophecy, even though every legal and moral authority in Greece agreed he was blameless. The weight of it was too much. The city itself felt cursed to him, I think. Haunted not by ghosts, but by the chain of choices and fears and desperate attempts to change what couldn't be changed that had led from Delphi's oracle to a discus field in Larissa. So he built something new instead. Mycenae rose on a hilltop between Argos and Corinth, massive stones fitted together so precisely that people would later say the Cyclopes must have built the walls. Perseus oversaw every detail. Where the gates would stand, how the citadel would be positioned, which spring would supply water during siege. He poured himself into the work the way you pour yourself into anything when you need to stop thinking about what you can't undo. Andromeda stayed with him through all of it. She understood, I think, that he needed to build something that was entirely his own, not inherited, not prophesied, not tangled up in the catastrophes that seemed to follow his bloodline like shadows. She walked the construction sites with him, offered opinions on where the palace should face, planted the first olive trees that would eventually shade the courtyards. They had children, several of them. Sons who would become kings, daughters who would marry into other royal lines. The dynasty he started would rule for generations. Longer than Argos, actually, which always struck me as deeply ironic. The city he couldn't bear to claim faded in importance, while the city he built from grief and determination became one of the great powers of Greece. But I don't think Mycenae's success was ever the point for Perseus. The point was the building itself. The daily, physical work of raising walls and digging foundations and turning empty hilltop into inhabited space. The point was having something to do with his hands besides remember how the discus had felt leaving them, how the wind had caught it, how his grandfather's eyes had looked staring up at nothing. He never spoke about Larissa publicly, never told the story, never explained, never tried to justify or process what happened in front of audiences. But I heard from those close to him that sometimes at night Andromeda would find him standing on the palace walls, looking south toward Argos. He wouldn't say anything. He'd just stand there like he was trying to figure out if he could have done something differently. I've wondered about that myself over the centuries. Could he have? Could anyone? Here's what I think Perseus learned, though I'm not sure he ever would have said it this way. You can be blameless and still carry blame. You can do everything right and still destroy what you love. You can run from prophecy your whole life or walk straight into it with eyes open, and either way it finds you exactly when and where it was always going to. Acrisius ran, Perseus didn't. And somehow they ended up in the same place anyway, on the same day in the same stadium, with bronze flying through air that should have been empty but wasn't. The oracle had said Acrisius would die by his grandson's hand, not kill, die by. Just that simple prepositional phrase, that tiny linguistic space where intention disappears and only outcome remains. Perseus's hand threw the discus. The wind, anyone's breath, everyone's breath, no one's breath, carried it. Acrisius's head stopped it. The prophecy didn't care about the mechanics, it just cared about completion. And what do you do with that? How do you live with being the instrument of fate rather than its agent? How do you build a life when you know the most important thing you ever did was something you didn't mean to do at all? Perseus built Mycenae. He raised his children. He ruled wisely and well. He grew old beside Andromeda and their love, which had started with sea monsters and desperate fathers and bronze chains on rocks, deepened into something quieter and more durable than romance. But I think he carried Larissa with him always. Not as guilt, exactly, and not as grief. More like knowledge, the kind of knowledge that changes how you walk through the world. He'd learned that being a hero doesn't protect you from being human, that you can kill Medusa and save your mother and still have your worst moment be an accident at a game in front of a crowd who came to celebrate someone else's father. He'd learned that prophecy doesn't make you powerful. It just makes you inevitable. And maybe he learned that you can't escape what you are, but you can choose what you build with the time you have left. Mycenae was that choice. Those massive walls, that careful planning, those children who would carry his name forward into a future he wouldn't see. Not redemption, exactly. Not compensation. Just something built on purpose by his own hands in defiance of nothing except the idea that fate gets to be the only story told about who he was. So that's how it happened. A discus, a breath of wind, and a prophecy that had been waiting patiently for 20 years finally got what it was owed. I've thought about that day in Larissa more times than I can count. I've replayed it in my mind, wondering if there was a moment, just one moment, where things could have gone differently. If Perseus had thrown a heartbeat earlier or later. If Acrisius had sat 3 rows back instead of 2. If the wind had been still that afternoon. But I don't think it would have mattered. Prophecy doesn't work like that. It's not waiting for the perfect moment. It's creating the moment, pulling all the threads together until the only possible outcome is the one that was spoken in Delphi all those years ago. Perseus and Acrisius were always going to end up in the same place at the same time. The how didn't matter. The why didn't matter. Only the what. And the what was this? A young man trying to enjoy being young, and an old man who spent his whole life afraid, and the distance between them collapsing in the time it takes bronze to fly through air. You've stayed with me through all 9 chapters of Perseus's story, from the bronze chamber where his mother was locked away to the stadium in Larissa where his grandfather died. We've watched him be born against impossible odds, survive what should have killed him, grow strong in exile, face monsters, save the woman he loved, free his mother, and accidentally fulfill the very prophecy his grandfather tried so hard to prevent. It's not a simple story. The best ones never are. Perseus wasn't perfect. He made mistakes, acted rashly sometimes, let anger drive him when wisdom might have served better. But he was brave when bravery mattered. He was kind to his mother. He loved Andromeda fiercely. And he learned painfully, terribly, that being a hero doesn't mean controlling your fate. It just means continuing forward even after fate has had its way with you. He built Mycenae. He raised children who became kings and queens. He grew old with the woman he loved. And every stone he laid, every wall he raised, every decision he made as a ruler was his own choice, made with his own hands, in defiance of the idea that prophecy gets to write the whole story. Maybe that's the real lesson, if there is one. Not that you can escape fate. You can't. But that what you build afterward, what you create in the space between prophecy's end and your own, that belongs to you alone. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sitting with me through these 9 episodes, through the difficult parts and the victories, through moments of joy and passages of terrible sorrow. Thank you for letting me tell you Perseus's story the way I remember it. Not as myth carved in marble, but as something lived, felt, carried forward by a young man who did his best with impossible circumstances. His story is finished now, but yours continues. And I hope when your own difficult moments come, when fate catches you sideways and you find yourself holding something you never meant to throw, I hope you remember Perseus. Remember that you can't always control what happens, but you can always choose what you build next. Take care of yourself. And if you ever find yourself in Mycenae, look at those massive walls and remember, a man built those. A man who killed his grandfather by accident at a game. A man who decided that one terrible moment wouldn't be the only thing his hands ever did. That's worth remembering, I think. Farewell, my friend. It's been an honor walking this road with you. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, before you go, one more thing. Traveler, if you enjoyed our time together in the halls of Olympus, there's a gift you can give in return. Just a little thing. Leave a 5-star rating and share this podcast with a friend or whisper it to the wind. The gods love a good rumor. And if you're curious about the mortal world, its twists, its triumphs, its tangled histories, come find me in my other podcast, History's Arrow. There, we follow the path of humanity, one story at a time. Until next time, walk wisely, speak kindly, and never underestimate the power of a good story. Your friend, Harmonia. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.